All right, well, it is a timely book, Boys, What It Means to Become a Man, Rachel Geese's new book out on HarperCollins. She joins me on the line. How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm very happy to have you. I have to imagine when you wrote this, you didn't necessarily predict the Toronto van attack and the fact that, like, incel would become a word, not just in your book, but in the common parlance.
No, not at all. In fact, I write a little bit about Elliot Rodger in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I was writing about it, that attack, his spree, I guess, I remember when it happened, it was talked about, and it was, it had that moment in the media of talking about, misogyny and extremism. But I think that the van attack in Toronto was horrific and tragic in its immediacy and in the lives lost and the people who were injured. But it also feels like at this moment, the way that we understand this kind of radical edge of misogyny, I feel is even different now than it was in the Elliot Rodger attack. I think post-Trump election, with the rise of white nationalism, we're seeing not just in the U.S. but around the world, after the killings in the mosque in Quebec,
mm-hmm.
I think we're thinking about and talking about this form of extremism in a different kind of way.
Right. Now, in the book, you mentioned that you started research around 2015, so pre-Trump, but there is material pulled from when you were doing work on like shorter pieces from about 2013. And I'm curious about kind of like at what point did this go from, stuff you were reporting on or writing kind of shorter things to I'm going to write about this as a book?
Yeah. Well, I've been writing about gender and sexuality and feminism for a long time, for a big chunk of my career. And then having a son made me, curious about boys and about, gender from the perspective of masculinity and from, and from the perspective of being the mother of a boy. And so I had been writing a little bit about, some things to do with boys or particularly, kids with, my son has learning disabilities. So writing a little bit about, experiences of parents with kids with learning disabilities within the school system.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2014, I wrote a piece, which was the inspiration for the book, about a program in Calgary called Wise Guys, which is a really terrific, comprehensive sexual health program for boys in grade 9. And so when I was putting the book together, I was drawing a bit on some of the work that I've been doing. I think that the book became its own thing when I started writing it in earnest in 2015. But then I realized I'd actually been thinking about a lot of these issues prior to that. That this had actually been, even though I think I wasn't conscious until 2015 that I was writing a book.
Right.
I think there was a lot of material that I had, written about and had been chewing on. And then, as the political climate changed, and things in the world which initially felt like very fringy suddenly became more mainstream and more urgent, made me, go back and look at some of the stuff I'd been thinking about a few years earlier.
So you went through a kind of a process of sifting through some of the stuff you'd written prior to that that fit within this rubric?
Yeah. I think, because when I started writing the book, I knew that I wanted to look at the ways in which the ideas of masculinity were created, and particularly the ways that boyhood was created, and to poke at or challenge the idea that there is a single boyhood, that there is an experience of growing up that all boys relate to. And I think what is far truer is that there's all different kinds of boyhoods, that one's identity as male is shaped not just by sex, but also by sexual orientation, gender identity, race, class, all of those things. These have been issues that I had addressed, more from through the lens of feminism, through the lens of writing about LGBTQ issues. And then the book was a way, I think, to pull together a lot of that thinking, and to be able to step back from some of the stuff that I'd written about earlier and look at it in a different kind of way.
So in looking at it a different way and then kind of pulling it together for the book, how did you go about determining kind of like the sections or the, you know, thematic things you wanted to touch upon?
Yeah, what I wanted to do was to look at some common spaces where I felt this sounds awfully academic, so I apologize for the kind of the academic jargon, but I wanted to, you know, look at the various places where the narrative of boyhood and masculinity were constructed. And so I, wanted to look at school and sports and popular culture and friendship and sex. I knew that those were sort of fairly, you know, in not wanting to generalize about boyhood, I did think that there were some fairly common experiences, like going through the school system or sports, even if boys don't play sports, having an interest in sports or having some sort of opinion about sports is a fairly common experience among boys. And then I wanted to set it up by actually digging into the question, kind of front and center about, you know, the nature versus nurture question. And then, so as I was working on the book, I was, you know, working on the chapter somewhat, like all at once. So I was doing some traveling and interviewing people. And I really wasn't at the early stages. I wasn't working on it, you know, methodically chapter by chapter, and couldn't quite. I knew that I had the chapters sorted, but I didn't really feel like I had an overarching framework or narrative. And then I came across the work of Promundo, which is a group that I profile in the book at the beginning, which is a group that does work with boys and young men around the world addressing issues of gender equality. And they put out a study called the Man Box, which was a survey of young men in the U.S., in the U.K., and in Mexico, asking them for their thoughts on the state of manhood for them at this moment, what they thought it meant to be a man. And that, for me, when I delved into that study and I could see how much in flux those definitions were, and that became, in a way, that the setup for the book itself was this idea of, there is this thing, you know, that's referred to as the man box, which is kind of a phrase that pulls together all the stereotypes and norms that exist about what it means to be male. Mm-hmm. And then sort of establishing that, then I felt I could chapter by chapter look at, you know, various points of a boy's life where he would encounter the messages of the man box.
Or what parts of the man box they might employ in sports or in education or things like that.
Absolutely. And, you know, I one of the things that, because, you know, the book isn't a parenting book and it isn't really a book about, you know, how to raise good boys. I really wanted it to be a kind of a cultural analysis. Because I think a lot of the things that people believe to be very true of boys or natural, there may be an inherent interest in, you know, things like sports, say, or there may be an inherent tendency towards aggression, perhaps. I don't really know, and I don't think that we could actually ever truly know, because it's so difficult to separate what we are born with and what we are socialized to
right.
do. But what I wanted to look at in the book is some of the things that I was getting told about my son, like sports are normal, all boys like sports. And my son is actually quite a sports nut. But I wanted to look at the history, the ways in which, sports were developed to actually create a particular form of masculinity, and that sports were very much... created, the sports that we know now were sort of formalized in the mid-19th century with a very clear agenda about, putting the backbone into boys that were perceived to be growing weak, and also very segregated. So sports were very much segregated by sex. So you know, girls were not engaged. They were discouraged from engaging in sports for a very long period of time. And then sports were also used as a way to kind of establish a kind of a white male elite. And, you know, you can see that through the early years of the professional sports that are played in North America. So, you know, we know in baseball that the sport was racially segregated as well. That happened as well in football. I don't think that there were players of color in hockey until the mid-50s or so. So, you know, sports weren't just this natural thing for boys. They were created with a real agenda and intention in mind to build a particular form of masculinity.
And kind of a colonial militaristic aspect to it as well.
Yeah. And similarly, you know, I trace a little bit of it in the scouting movement, which was, you know, came to be around the same time that, you know, that the sports that we know today were being formalized for similar reasons. The scouting movement was created in Britain by Robert Baden-Powell, very much in a reaction to what he saw as the weakening of the British Empire, the weakening of the upper class British male citizen, and a desire to create kind of a paramilitary force that would exist to help protect the empire. So, you know, I think that our understanding of Boy Scouts now, or Cubs, is, you know, very sweet and very innocent. It's kids learning badges and going camping. And but, you know, the roots of that movement, you know, did have a particular, you know, colonizing agenda.
Yeah, it comes across as kind of like a softer Hitler Youth in the telling of it.
Yeah, I mean, certainly. I mean, I think that, I think it's important to note the ways in which, you know, boys have been recruited into this form of masculinity, at great personal risk to themselves. I mean, you know, we know that in wars and in military campaigns, you know, we have historically expected very young men to sacrifice their lives without them having very much agency and choice in the matter.
Right. So did you anticipate kind of doing a lot of this like historical research in terms of like boyhood and masculinity? Like, was that something you knew you were going to do when you approached this project, or did that kind of sort itself out in tackling sort of different topics that you needed to kind of go backwards to go forward?
I think I did. I have a background in history. I have a history major and from university. And so I've always found, you know, I think for me, it's a way in. I mean, the book has a lot of sociology in it. And I think that's in part because, you know, I think this study of, you know, gender and sociology have this very, you know, it's very robust, looking at the way that gender is created and gender norms are created. But for me, I think it's useful because I think so many of our contemporary conversations are ahistorical. They exist outside of a context. So when people say, well, this is how things have always been, this is just how things are, what I found really useful is to actually cast back a decade or two decades or a century and think, this hang-up that we have, this is actually a new hang-up. Or, you know, this understanding that, you know, male friendship, like that we have, that there exists a kind of homophobic sort of fear about men being too intimate. Well, that would have been completely surprising during the Romantic period, when there was this, it was very normal to have a very gushing expressions of affection between men. And likewise, I found it really important to be able to, you know, we're it's been going on now for about, you know, 20 or 30 years, this idea of the boy crisis in school, the idea that as girls are doing better in school, boys are falling behind. And there's been all kinds of, you know, theories about this having to do with boy brains being different than girl brains, or having to do with a kind of a feminist agenda having taken over classrooms. So the idea that boys are in crisis, that boys are in trouble, I mean, that's not a new thing either. There have been these, you know, various periods in history that usually coincided with other forms of social upheaval. So during the Industrial Revolution, mm-hmm. You know, in the period after the Second World War, where there is the kind of these moments of kind of conformity and moral panic that occur around boys. And so I kind of knew going into the book that I was interested in using history as a way to challenge some of these assumed truths about how boys are, or why boys are the way that they are, or how it is that we have come to view boys in a particular kind of way.
Yeah. Now, with regards to the education section, you know, you talk about your own son's like learning disability and the fact that these are more diagnosed with boys, but the fact that there may be an inclination to diagnose boys with this behavior and disregard it in girls. And I'm curious about kind of like, is this something you expected or anticipated when you started writing this chapter, that there was evidence that, you know, as you say, scientifically, the difference between a female and male brain is less of a difference than the human brain to any other.
Mm-hmm. Hello?
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. Sorry, I think we just cut out for a second.
Yeah.
You were asking, you were talking about the differences between girl brains and boy brains.
Right, and did you anticipate, like, kind of learning that maybe the differentiation between the two as, you know, learning styles, and that ADHD among boys doesn't work within education, but that the fact, like, there may be fewer diagnoses of it amongst girls, but that it may affect all kids with these kind of learning styles, and that it's not quite as much of a structural problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, I think that the conversations we have about sex difference and schooling and I think we need to have way more complicated and complex conversations than we're having now. I think it's a really appealing idea for a lot of people to say, well, boys and girls are very different, and boys can't sit still, and, you know, girls are just better at language, and boys are better at math and science. And, you know, the research is really mixed on that. You know, you can find studies that do suggest that girls develop language a bit more quickly than boys do. There seems to also be some research that suggests that, you know, kids are actually far more alike than different, but there seems to be more boys at the outliers. So you have a group of kids that sort of exist in the kind of the middle capacity of, you know, satisfactory to very good. But you'll tend to find more boys at the very low achieving end, and more boys at the very high achieving end. I mean, there's been some research on that. Again, it's hard to know because it's really impossible to piece out inherent capacity versus socialization. You know, because we know very early on that kids are stereotyped, you know, from even before birth. You know, if you'll find out you're a woman is carrying a boy or a girl, all of a sudden a lot of biases and expectations come into play, and they are almost impossible to escape. I think, you know, the work that was coming out in the sort of 80s and 90s about, you know, the boy crisis and boys failing in schools was coming at the beginning of diagnoses around ADHD, and then sort of subsequently, you know, a real uptick in incidences of autism spectrum disorder, which seems to disproportionately affect boys. But as you point out, it could be just that we're not recognizing it and diagnosing it in girls. It could be that girls do better in school because perhaps their brains are developing more quickly, or it could be that we reward girls for doing well in school, that we, you know, explicitly or implicitly, you know, have those expectations for girls, mm-hmm. where we implicitly and explicitly maybe don't have the same expectations for boys. And certainly there's been some really interesting research to suggest that boys from particular backgrounds feel that it is unmanly to, you know, try hard in school, to work really hard, to study hard, to raise their hand in class, that they associate that with being kind of, you know, being like a girl or being kind of gay. And so there's a stigma attached to, boys showing a real effort and an interest in schooling. So, you know, taken all together, I think that the boy crisis, if it is, you know, and I'm not, and I think it doesn't exist in the way that it's been talked about in the first place, but I also think the factors for why girls and boys may be doing, you know, succeeding in different ways at school, I think it's, there are just way more complicated factors at play than simply girl brains and boy brains are different.
Right. You mentioned implicit bias, and a couple of things that you note are really fascinating with regards to that. One is about, you know, if a woman knows she's carrying a boy or a girl, and then, you know, the description of, you know, the kicking in the womb being the word choice changes as to being kind of like mm-hmm. more aggressive with the boys.
Mm-hmm.
And then even, you know, when you talk about, you know, teachers being told, oh, watch these four students for possible trouble. And then, you know, the black boy is considered the one that was most trouble, then the white boy. And, you know, like that the expectations are already there that the troublemakers are the boys in the classroom, even if mm-hmm. they're behaving in the exact same way and there is no misbehavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we, you know, again, this, I mean, I think that, you know, in the last couple of weeks, this question of implicit bias has come up around the two African-American men that were at a Starbucks in
yes.
Philadelphia. And, you know, they came in, they were waiting for a friend. They sat down at a table to wait, and one of the baristas got very agitated and assumed they were up to no good and called the police. And, you know, these were just a couple of guys waiting for a friend to have a meeting. And yet their presence in this space was assumed to be in some way threatening and troubling. And so I think that is, you know, one very, you know, horrible recent example about how this bias plays out. But, you know, it's present in schools. Administrators are much more likely to more harshly punish black boys and indigenous boys than they are other than white boys, say, and Asian boys. They seem to assume that those boys, when they act out, that their that behavior gets addressed in a much more severe way with much heavier consequences. And also black and indigenous boys are less likely than other boys to be recommended for gifted programs or kind of, you know, specialized programs like specialized STEM programs and enriched programs. And so, you know, I suspect a lot of those teachers would not think of themselves as racist. I suspect a lot of those teachers and administrators probably believe that they are doling out punishment equally and even-handedly. But when you actually look at the numbers, you see that, you know, particular groups of boys are disproportionately more harshly punished in the school system.
Yeah, no, definitely like the disproportionate figures are. And then, you know, you talk about the school to pipeline, prison pipeline in the States, that, you know, the black boys that get expelled, the likelihood of them ending up in prison. I think you quote one of the education authorities as saying, you know, it's basically like you might as well, when you kick them out of school, reserve a spot for them in the prison.
Yeah, because, you know, it's the more and more you are thrown out of school, then school becomes a hostile place, and kids get the message that they don't that no one is going to put time into helping them, that the solution will be they'll be cast out of a community. And you know, we see that, you know, in Ontario where I live, when a zero tolerance policy was put into place in the elementary school system, suspensions and expulsions skyrocketed. And the schools didn't necessarily become any safer. It just pushed problems outside of the school, and it alienated a whole bunch of children. And I think, you know, one of the things that we forget in these cases is these are children. You know, they may well be children who are behaving in ways that appear disturbing or troubling, but they're still kids, and they still deserve protection and care and somebody trying to help them, you know, get the help they need so that they're not acting out in school, so that, you know, and again, my experience with my own son, certainly, and then talking to other parents who have, you know, dealt with similar situations is, you know, often kids who have learning disabilities of certain kinds, you know, when they're freaked out, when they're scared and when they're anxious, often they can be very oppositional. They can, you know, throw stuff around a room or bolt out of a classroom. And that behavior is often seen as, well, they're just being bad. They're being bad kids. In fact, that behavior is a result of them being very frightened, very overwhelmed. And, you know, the behavior is certainly disruptive. And I understand why schools want to deal with it in a serious way. But I think what they forget is that the child who is exhibiting that behavior needs help. They're freaked out. They're scared. They're frustrated. They're overwhelmed. They're often out of their own control. And so being overtly punitive doesn't fix things for them.
No, it's a limit in their capacity to behave according to, you know, expectations, but it's not a pathological thing.
Yeah.
The pop culture section. Obviously there's been, as you cite with, you know, the Columbine kids being the thing being attributed to Marilyn Manson and even further back, other, you know, actions or behaviors attributed to rap music or violent movies or video games and things like that. I thought it was very interesting. One of the people you talked to, you know, admitted they ended up playing video games with their child and realized, oh, you know, there's problem solving. There's, you know, collaborative work here. There's more to it than what I saw on the outside as a parent and judging it. And I was curious, you know, because you talk about your own experience with your son and worry about him playing Grand Theft Auto and then making a deal that he can play Call of Duty. What was the experience like for you, and what was the experience about, you know, talking to this other person about their path?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of those, you know, I think that this is, I think, quite a universal experience for parents is, you know, trying to understand popular culture. And I think even parents who feel like they're fairly hip and fairly connected to popular culture, I think are like, oh my God, what is my kid, like, who is this, you know, who is my kid watching on YouTube, or what is going on in this video game, or what are these lyrics of this song? And so I think part of it is just being freaked out by a new technology where parents are just unfamiliar with it. They just don't get it. And, you know, that heightens the anxiety. You know, I think that there are images in video games and a culture surrounding video games that can be quite troubling, can be, you know, racist and sexist.
Mm-hmm.
However, you know, there's been no credible research that shows a direct cause and effect between playing violent video games and real life violence. You know, I think that some of the imagery in video games may desensitize kids to a degree. I think some of the way in which women are portrayed or people of color are portrayed within video games may amplify already existing biases. But in fact, we know that as, you know, video games have exploded in popularity, actual violence continues to go down. I mean, we're on a sort of a 30-year downward trend of violence and crime in North America. So, you know, I think that what I learned as a parent when it came to video games, I'm not a gamer, I'm not super interested in them, but that doesn't mean that they lack value. And I think it's super easy as someone outside of a culture, if you don't understand it, to dismiss it outright. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to do was to check my own biases. And, you know, I don't play with my son that much, but I'll watch him play games, or, you know, he'll show me a YouTube video of a gamer he really likes and talk to me about it. And, you know, it's been a really important thing to show him that I'm interested in the things that interest him, to give value to his world and to show him that I take it seriously and I respect it. Because if I give him that courtesy and that respect, then we can actually have a meaningful conversation about, you know what, I think this kind of gaming is appropriate for you at this age. However, you know, I don't like this. Or even around Grand Theft Auto, you know, I find it really objectionable. And, I mean, at this point, you know, it's just like when you're 18, if you want to buy that game for yourself, you go for it. But not right now. There's other things you can do. Mm-hmm. And that's where I draw the line. And I don't know, like I say in the book, maybe that's just dumb and arbitrary. But, you know, we've been able to find a compromise with our son, which I actually think, you know, was a good thing for him. Like, I actually think ultimately he felt okay about that, because I think he actually felt like I was respecting him and listening to him and letting him make his case, and we could come up with a compromise. And, you know, the parents that I talk to who do game with their kids talk about it being really great. They feel like they really bond with their kids. You know, I see with my son, he games. He has a cousin that lives in a different city, and he games with his cousin a lot, and it's a way for him to hang out with his cousin that he wouldn't normally get to do. So I think that there is, you know, like, you know, in the same way that people get very anxious about social media, and understandably so, there are things to be concerned about. And at the same time, I think, you know, platforms like YouTube have been incredible platforms for a wider representation of people's lives, and they've allowed people to create their own media. And I think that's a pretty thrilling thing for young people.
Right. The person I was trying to remember, his name was Clive Thompson, that you quote, yeah, as being, you know, if you want to speak to your child with authority, you better have some authority on the subject, was what he had said.
Yes.
And I thought that was great. Like, that was an eye opener for me to read that, yeah, you know, can't just dismiss something, or else you come across as dogmatic. And the way I infer from what you write about with your son is that this allows you to then, you know, talk to them about, like, critical media consumption. That, like, mm-hmm. you know, when you're playing a game, if you were to just say, oh, it's bad, they're going to shut down, versus, you know, talking to them about, like, what do you think about the representation of, you know, minority people within this game? Or, mm-hmm. you know, what do you think about the violence towards women in this game? Mm-hmm. And things like that. And those are conversations you can't have if you just shut them down.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we've been able to have, my son is really into, I don't know if you, are you a gamer person at all? Do you?
I probably skew towards the type of games that you as a parent would have been totally fine with, like the sports games and the Lego
right.
games.
Yeah. Well, he's really obsessed with Fortnite, which is like this, you know, huge, like, sensation. Like, you know, it's this massive, huge global game. And one of the things that's quite interesting about it is there are a lot of female characters in the game, and they're strong and they're tough, and they fight. They fight male characters, and, you know, they some of them have still the kind of Street Fighter kind of curvaceous Vavumi body, mm-hmm. but they're wearing, like, you know, like proper boots that they can run in. They've got muscles. And, you know, my son and I talk about that. Like, he'll actually say, look at the girls in this game. Like, I think you'll approve, because they're strong women in this game. And, you know, so I think that he's able to recognize, right, like, there are images of girls in pop culture, girls and women in pop culture, that show them to be sort of weak and just sexual objects. And then there are images that show women to be strong and capable and tough, and to be able to look at it and say, oh, right, that's something that portrays girls and women one way, and here's something that portrays them in a different kind of way. And instead of just kind of and this other thing too is, I think that, you know, kids aren't just passively consuming this stuff. Mm-hmm. I think that they are thoughtful, and I think we can also work to give them more, you know, critical thinking abilities. And, you know, I loved Clive's point, too, when he said, you know, if we want to talk to our kids with authority, we better have authority, because I think, you know, too often we can dismiss, like, music where we find lyrics objectionable and think, oh, that's just like that. Those lyrics are trashy or they're offensive. But then if we actually talk to kids about, like, why do you like that song? And they might say, well, the song's really angry, and sometimes I'm angry, and I like to listen to angry music when I'm angry, and it, you know, or the song makes me feel powerful, or I think the song is kind of not, I don't think it's literal. I think it's actually maybe it's a parody, and that's, you know, so I think that actually, you know, you can have conversations with kids about this stuff rather than just shutting it down. And having that ability to think critically is like that's a tremendous skill to have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think respecting our kids, I mean, it's also a real gift as adults to respect kids' culture and the things that they care about. I mean, no one likes being told the things that they like are stupid or bad.
Right.
That's just a horrible thing to have somebody tell you.
And it kind of ties back to something you talk about in sort of the section on emotion and you know, the notion of kids, maybe boys being circumspect or unable to convey emotion, is that, you know, maybe we should stop talking at the boys and listen to mm-hmm. them, because they may demonstrate this capacity.
Yeah. And we may also, I mean, we may also try to, like, work harder at, I think sometimes because boys aren't encouraged or taught emotional language, I think we need to get better at using a big emotional vocabulary with boys starting at a very young age. So we're, you know, reading them stories or showing them movies that have like a rich emotional terrain. And I also think we need to have our antenna up to recognize that just because a boy might not be talking directly about his emotions doesn't mean he's not experiencing emotions. So I think that, like when I was talking earlier about sometimes kids act out when they're stressed out or they're overwhelmed or they're frustrated. So it might be that a boy who is misbehaving or acting in ways that are inappropriate or hurtful, that may be a way for, he might be trying to express something in that. He might be trying to say something that he doesn't feel like he has permission or doesn't feel like he has the capacity to express in another way. And so I think in helping boys name their feelings or even just to have conversations, like, you know, when my son was finishing up grade 8, he's in grade 9 this year, just to talk a little bit about, hey, how are kids feeling about grade 8 ending? Are you guys talking about going to different schools? What, you know, do you think, you know, who are you going to miss when school is over? Or, you know, are there things that you're excited about or you're worried about? Or what would make you feel safe in your new school? Or what do you think would help you feel more comfortable? And, you know, my son didn't always answer those questions, like, you know, really fulsomely.
Mm-hmm.
But at least I put it on, like, we just wanted to put it on the table as so he understands that leaving grade 8 and going into grade 9 is a big deal, and he might have feelings about it. And just to almost anticipate that this is a big change, and that there would be some emotions attached to it, and that we wanted just to let him know that there was permission to have those feelings, even if he didn't really want to talk about them or talk about them with us, just to say, this is a big deal. This thing that's coming up is big, and you may have big, big, complicated feelings about it.
Creating an environment where they know they can, even if they're not prepared to yet.
Yeah.
Like you said, this is sort of a sociological and historical study and not necessarily like a parenting book, but there are, you know, some pointers and things to take away from it that, you know, could be concrete. And you do talk to a bunch of people from organizations and schools mm-hmm. and things like that, that seem to point to a way, and you know, in your sort of acknowledgements, you mm-hmm. you say these are the people that create a path for us.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel hopeful?
Yeah, I do. I really do. And I want to be Pollyannish about it, but I truly do, because I think that there are really smart and caring people who are showing up for children. And I think I feel hopeful having, you know, seen, I mean, you know, we're still a long way from, you know, full equality for girls and for, you know, girls to have equal access to opportunities. But, you know, certainly I can see in the course of my lifetime, I was a kid who I was really good at math. And I remember being told when I was in high school by a math teacher that I didn't need to work so hard because I was a girl and I was never going to really use math anyway. I think that was said with a kind of cavalier, like it was completely appropriate to tell a young woman in the 80s that kind of thing. I think that we would be so shocked if somebody now said that to a girl in grade 10. And if they did, I think that we would have people furious over it. And so when I look around and I see, you know, these daughters of my friends who are so bold and strong, and they're playing sports and they're doing dance and they're making movies and they're, you know, that they have these big ambitions and they're confident and they're thoughtful. I think, okay, well, we created a space for girls to flourish. And so I feel like we did it for girls, and I feel like we can also, you know, continue to do that work from a slightly different vantage point for boys, where we say to boys, it's okay to be tender, it's okay to be vulnerable. And we can also, I think, hold boys to account at the same time to say, you know, to give them space to have their feelings, but to also not let boys believe that they are more valuable than girls, or that their feelings are more important than anybody else's feelings, that they are, like every human being, entitled to have feelings and to have their full humanity. And by extension, I think then they in turn become more compassionate and caring and empathetic. You can look at something like the van attack in Toronto, and feel incredibly, sorrowful over it. And it's a horrible thing that happened. And yet I feel like we actually have a language to talk about it. And I feel like we have so many people on the ground who, and they run the gamut from people who are very like lefty and progressive in their politics. And they come at it from that point of view. And then, you know, there's this football coach in West Texas that I talked to, mm-hmm. who is a very conventional, traditional, religious man, who is also doing this work of talking to boys about being thoughtful and compassionate and respectful towards women. And he's also doing the work of making sure that, you know, if boys are going to be aggressive on the football field, they learn how to leave it on the field and not bring it into the rest of their lives. And so I think I was also moved not just by seeing people do this work with young men, but also to see the diversity of the people who are doing this work with young men.
Right, that they shouldn't be hemmed into a man box, that there is a spectrum of masculinity that needs
for
to be
sure.
explored, in the same way that, you know, femininity has been opened wide, and that there are a multitude of possibilities for both sexes.
Yeah, absolutely. And not to say, you know, and I also want to say that, you know, I think that masculinity, you know, it's one of the guys in the book says, you know, he doesn't want to, like, the traditional kind of, you know, strong, you know, dude into sports is a really important form of masculinity for a lot of guys. I mean, I also know trans men for whom the experience of finally being able to identify as male was a really lifelong fight for them, to feel like, I want to be a guy, I want to be a dude. So I don't think that, you know, like masculinity has to be a bad thing or is a bad thing. I think that there are versions of masculinity that are brutal and harmful. But, you know, being male is not an inherently bad thing by any means. And I think that's why it's really important to talk about, you know, masculinity. I mean, you know, again, to get kind of academic, people talk about the performance of femininity and the performance of masculinity. And I think it's really good to kind of separate that, because then when we talk about, you know, I know the term toxic masculinity is a term that rankles people. because they feel like it's talking about men being toxic.
Right.
But I think it's useful. I think it's useful in that it's not toxic men. It's toxic masculinity. It's an expression of masculinity that is harmful and ugly and destructive. It's not, you know, so I think it's useful to think about masculinity as something that to a degree, you know, I think I'm more on the social construction side than on the biological side, but I think that most people can agree that there are lots of ways in which we express our femininity or our masculinity that are social constructs that are created, and we can choose to embrace them and embrace the more positive and the more positive qualities rather than embracing the ones that say, you know, being male means being a good man, being a real man means having power over other people and controlling other people. And I think that's different than saying, you know, being a good man means being strong and kind and helpful and supportive. I mean, that to me sounds like a really positive definition of masculinity.
Right. It's a very important conversation, and hopefully this book adds to that conversation. The book is Boys, What It Means to Become a Man. Rachel Giza, thanks very much for taking some time to talk about it.
Oh, thank you so much. It was really lovely to talk to you.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I'm the father of four boys, so.
Wow.
This
How
is,
old?
The oldest is 9, so 9, 6, 4, and 19 months.
Holy cow, you got your hands full.
Yeah. And when I found out about this book, I was like, oh my God, I have to read this book. So I appreciated it because there are some times where I'm kind of admittedly dismissive of some of the things. And I was like, oh, this challenges my ability to talk to my sons about, you know, watching YouTube videos and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, it's been really, I mean, the thing that I just keep getting struck by again and again is just like, you know, I was at a talk last night at the launch of my book, and the fellow that was talking with me, Todd Meinerson, who used to run the White Ribbon Campaign that works for gender equality. And one of the things that he was talking about is, you know, recognizing, you know, like when you see like little boys, like, you know, toddlers and like 3, 4, 5 year olds, like just how sweet and tender and vulnerable they are.
Oh, yeah.
And the kind of like, well, what happens where they feel like they have to shut all that down. And what I see with my own son, who's now about to turn 15, is, you know, like he's got, you know, a very healthy sense of teenage boy swagger. And, you know, he's a jock in many ways, but he's also incredibly tender and sweet and a really loyal friend. You know, it's been really lovely to, I mean, one of the things that's been so cool about, you know, I have a sister. I didn't grow up around boys in that way, is I spend a lot of time in the company of boys, and I'm so struck by just their sweetness and their tenderness. And I feel like the whole boys will be boys kind of conversation or boys don't cry really does them a disservice, because I just know, you know, many incredible young men. And I think in the same way too, like I think, you know, the van attack was a very real example of a really ugly form of misogyny. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I hold is there were also like a number of young men who came forward and were performing CPR and were helping the victims, right? So
right.
It's also like I really want to hold that out for my son to be able to say to him, like, you know, there are men who are behaving in really gross ways right now, and we have to talk about that, but then also to be able to hold out, like, and here are men who are behaving in super honorable ways. Like, you know, like there are, you know, like you can be a good guy, and, you know, you have that choice and that agency.
Yeah. It's a interesting time to raise boys in this environment. Cause you know, my son's our oldest, he listens to the news and he reads the paper and stuff like that. And when Trump was elected, like you know, he went to bed before the election results were in. And the next morning when we told him, and he was just like, how? Like, why would people like support a guy who behaves that way? And like, you know, it just seemed so foreign to him that a person would, you know, think that about other people and behave in that way. And so it's like, well, you know, if he can continue on this path, I hope, you know, others like him. But yeah, no, yesterday my four-year-old, I picked him up from daycare and we were walking home and he asked to hold my hand. And he's like, holding hands is the best, huh, Dad? So there's definitely that like genuine, like affectionate and loving side to them that hopefully is nurtured.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And that's the thing. Like, I think that there's a lot to learn. Like, I think that the boys are kind of hungering for that. I think they're hungering to be taken seriously. I think they're hungering to be heard. And I think that they're hungering to be able to express themselves. And so, yeah, I don't think I could have written a negative or pessimistic book being the mother of a son because, you know, I want good things for him, you know?
Right. And you believe in his capacity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thanks again for your time, Rachel. I really appreciate it. And
yeah, and will you send me or Melissa a link when it, like will it?
Yeah, so it's going to air on Friday.
Okay,
but
fabulous.
Then I'm going to post the interview just by itself, like it's part of a larger show.
Right.
But I'll post the interview by itself on SoundCloud and send the link. If you want, I can send it to you as well. But
sure. Do you have my email? Do you have my?
I don't.
Okay, it's my first. So Rachel RACHEL dot. Giese, G-I-E-S-E, at Rogers.com.
At Rogers.com. Okay. I will send you the link on Friday when it's up.
Fabulous. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Take care.
Bye.